This essay is called Why Every Brand Encounter Counts. You read a compelling advertisement for a piece of electrical equipment, and you buy it. And then you open the instruction manual. It is incomprehensible in 7 languages. The advertisement understood the reader. The manual does not. In design and empathy, the brand of the advertisement and the brand of the manual have nothing whatever in common. For the purchaser, these first moments of ownership are crucial. Critical faculties are on full alert. Apprehension lurks. Reassurance is anxiously awaited. And that's exactly when the dreaded manual strikes. Not only has a perfect opportunity been lost to confirm new users in the wisdom of their choice, but a perverse and willful act of brand mutilation has been committed. For the best part of 50 years now, we have spoken confidently about brand image and brand reputation. Nobody has seriously challenged the view that people hold opinions about products and services that are based on more than just function and direct experience. This shared understanding has helped shape and improve all conventional marketing communications. No one much doubts that advertising, direct marketing, promotions, public relations, and pack design, among others, can enhance the reputations of competitive enterprise. They don't have to be objects, to the benefit of buyers and sellers both. Where we've been less assiduous, perhaps because we sensed the quest would be such a nightmare, is in trying to identify the less obvious sources of a brand's reputation. Imagine for a moment that it was possible to scan the human brain, isolate the cell that contained that particular brain's opinion of a particular brand, its image, and then trace and log its origins. Not for one second should we expect to see just a few strong, clearly differentiated wires labeled experience, advertising, word of mouth, presentation. If we successfully traced and identified every encounter that had contributed over time to that brain's view of that brand, the resultant three-dimensional map would be like a huge bowl of multicolored spaghetti. Too complex, too confusing, too interrelated to be of any immediate value. But that's no reason for pretending that they don't exist. The non-conventional contributors to brand reputation are already more important than we admit, and every social and technological change is making them more so. With a greater understanding of these less famous brand ingredients and some canny management, a real opportunity for competitive advantage presents itself, and at virtually no cost. In surveying the entire range of brand encounters, we can identify 2 clear and coincident scales. One of simplicity, and one of control. The communications we favour and will rightly continue to favour are relatively simple both to manage and to monitor. Advertising, direct marketing, pricing, promotions, public relations, sponsorship, packaging, the brand website, in-store display, all in different ways and at different times affect any single individual's impression of a brand. As marketers, we take them all seriously, pay more than lip service to the concept of integrated communications, and strive hard to see that the signals that each activity sends out are consistent, coherent, and complementary. All these activities, diverse as they are, have much in common. They are all planned, paid for, and executed by the brand's owners. Control of both quantity and content lies with the company. They are all transmissions, broadcast from the company to its consuming public. They are deliberately engineered brand encounters, and as encounters go, they are seductive in nature. Their primary intention is to court custom. This form of brand communication is at least 1,000 years old as the town crier, and probably older. Town crier publicity brings news to the people. It may be difficult to plan and expensive to execute, but its value has never been more widely recognized. Demand for all forms grows in real terms year by year. It will continue to be the basis of reputation for any competitive enterprise, from candy bars at 25 cents to executive cars at $100,000. It will continue to be the first serious marketing investment made by every internet debutante. So valuable are these simple, controllable, conventional encounters that it is tempting to believe that they are the only contributors to brand reputation, and all that efficient brand management entails is sitting high up in the corporate palace, monitoring brand transmissions worldwide for relevance and consistency. But there are other sources, many other sources, from which we as consumers derive our opinion of brands. Some of them are within the control of the company, though not necessarily of brand management, and some of them lie almost completely outside management control and influence. They're getting more numerous and more important with every day that passes, but so fragmented are they, crossing and challenging traditional corporate structures and budgets, that many companies choose not to think about them at all. So first, a look at some of those brand encounters which technically lie within the company's control, yet only rarely seem to be consciously directed or monitored. It's as if we believe that only conventional communications will be noted by our publics, and that all other encounters will be screened out. But no manifestation of a brand is ever ignored, and all will make some contribution, positive or negative, to that brand's reputation. The ill-conceived and incomprehensible instruction manual is one such example. But there are many other brand encounters which differ from seductive encounters, in that they all have a reason for existence other than the courtship of the consumer. It's just such a pity that this primary function so often seems to blind companies to their potential for simultaneous and free brand building. It's odd how little brand use is made of trucks. Vast travelling billboards already paid for thunder up and down the highways being seen by hundreds of thousands of people, yet with little or nothing on their sides to promote or enhance the company or the brand. Can it be, I wonder, in the corporate structure that trucks come under transport rather than communications? And who is a transport manager to know about brand values? The contribution of architecture to corporate brands is widely debated but infrequently practiced. At a time when all are agreed that corporate brands need to be as clearly differentiated one from another as repeat purchase consumer goods, tens of millions can be committed to buildings and internal design without a single reference made to the likely effect on the ultimate consumer. It's as if senior management believes that creating a competitive reputation can safely be left to the hard hands in the marketing department and is nothing whatever to do with them. Financial services companies were slow to understand the need for simple brand distinction, but they're catching up fast. Savings schemes and pension plans are now packaged far more attractively, and the language in which they are described is sometimes even coherent. But then you get a letter from head office, and your conclusion is immediate. The presentation was a sham, no more than cosmetic. Behind that glossy package lies a company as bureaucratic, self-obsessed, and insensitive as we always knew such companies to be. In its advertising, in its planned seductive encounters, a large British financial institution makes much of its friendliness. But a recent head office communication from the same company contained the following sentence: "This is a computer-generated message and therefore has no signature." The fury provoked by poorly trained people in call centres and by interminable pass-the-parcel voicemail systems has been widely reported. But until somebody quantifies the cost of that fury and the damage it does to a company's bottom line, little improvement is likely. These are wasted opportunities, contacts between brand and brand user which have to happen which are within the company's control, but because their primary function is other than brand communication, are thought to have no brand effect. The majority of marketing companies do not think of them as media, do not monitor them as media, and therefore make no attempt to integrate them with more conventional media. Their customers, however, their buying public, make no such distinction. And so substantial sums of money, which could have reinforced brand values from unexpected directions, are at best underutilized and at worst counterproductive. There are many more brand encounters of this kind, all essentially anarchic in nature. By failing to confirm the brand's true spirit, they challenge it, and so brand authority is needlessly diminished. Even more slippery to deal with, but with even greater future implications, are the chance encounters. Just as we bump into friends and relations, so we bump into brands. These accidental interfaces are almost completely outside the control or influence of the brand owner, but their effect on the public can be significant. Because they are so disparate and diffuse, chance encounters seldom earn a mention in a communication strategy document. Because they are almost impossible to foresee, control, or orchestrate, they tend to be totally ignored. Here are just a few examples. A story in the press about racial discrimination at a brand's factory. A meeting with a friend who has a friend who's just been sacked by the company that makes the brand. A crusading website devoted to your company's pay policy in the Middle East. A product recall for safety reasons. A cardboard outer bearing the brand name in an untidy corner of a supermarket. Dangerous driving by a clearly branded truck. Rumoured financial problems at the holding company, a scare story started by an industrial blackmailer, a discarded wrapper in a well-tended park, a widely reported case against the company for sexual discrimination, two cars of the same make broken down at the roadside within a mile of each other. You could add another 100, the majority trivial, a few potentially catastrophic. Most chance encounters are negative in impact, and every single one of them will have some lasting effect on people's aggregate belief in a brand, and therefore on its success and profitability. Every change that's taking place today increases both the number and the effect of such unhappy accidents. The age of the freestanding brand is nearly over. For reasons widely understood, most brands now, and nearly all new brands, trumpet the name of their parent. The parent may be a company or a master brand, but the reasoning is the same. Let's leverage our brand equity. Let's trade on the trust we've already so painstakingly and expensively built. But of course, just as the good news can be shared and spread through such linkages, so can the bad. Freestanding brands, orphan brands with no known parents, may be non-contagious. But when brand relationships are not just public but widely publicized, bad news from one can rapidly become an epidemic. The effect of the internet is to accelerate the chances of brand contagion. The internet means that there is nowhere to hide. You cannot charge $350 for a pair of chinos and pay third world workers $3.50 a day to make them and hope to go unnoticed. You cannot deprive your own workforce of knowledge of your company's performance when they have ready access to it elsewhere. Today, to a marked extent, all brands are service brands. Other than street traders, few businesses now see their only function as being simply to make a sale. After-sales service, relationship marketing, the concept of lifetime value, the growth of interactive media, all these trends and developments mean that a few unfortunate chance encounters can poison a consumer's mind forever and undo the effect of all those seductive encounters so expensively engineered by the marketing department. The one great certainty about all long-term relationships, of course, is that they go through rocky patches. The maintenance of immaculate service standards is even harder to achieve than the maintenance of product standards. Errors are inevitable. But if chance encounters are really chance and lie well outside a company's sphere of control, surely that means that there is no sensible corrective action the company can take. But there is. In this new and open commercial world, future prizes will go not just to those who make the fewest mistakes, but also to those who recover, apologize, and make amends most gracefully. There is ample evidence that a brand that takes corrective action quickly and sympathetically will not only be forgiven, but may well, as a result, find itself even more thoroughly trusted. And it is here that the great neglected army of the workforce demands new attention. When nearly all brands are service brands, when it is the people behind the brand who provide the long-term reassurance, when news and information about brands is freely accessible from the internet and elsewhere, and when the gracious correction of inevitable error becomes a competitive necessity, that's when an intelligent, informed, and trusted staff can turn even the catastrophic brand encounter into a reinforcement of brand loyalty. This means opening up the whole marketing strategy to absolutely everyone. It means confiding in them and training them and asking them for constructive suggestions. It means trusting them to respond to customer dissatisfaction both immediately and personally without cowering behind head office instructions. It means as conscious an application of internal marketing, internal communications, as we give to our external marketing. Sometimes, mesmerized by the new media, we neglect to make full use of the old. Whether seductive, anarchic, or catastrophic, the number of brand encounters can only multiply. Each one is an opportunity. But to make the most of them, the function of brand management needs to be radically redefined.